The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am very pleased to welcome our two writers this evening. These are two authors whose books brim with irony and use the art of narrative to explore the nature and nurture of that complex we call identity. Howard Jacobson returns with the latest entry in the Hogarth Shakespeare series, reimagining The Merchant of Venice while exploring issues of Jewish identity in the character of Shylock and art dealer and conflicted father, Simon Strulevich. Mr. Jacobson will fill you in on the rest of the story. You may think you know it, but you don't. As I'm sure you know, he is one and possibly the only author who has been nominated manifold times, that's more than a few, for the Man Booker Prize. His novel, The Finkler Question, won the award in 2010. The author's many works of fiction include The Mighty Walzer, Kaluki Nights, Jay, and Zoo Time, for which he first and last appeared here in 2014. You may or may not be surprised to learn that Mr. Jacobson is a scholar of Shakespeare, and that his first book, co-written with Wilbur Sanders, Shakespeare's Magnanimity, was published in 1979. And that's also why you won't be surprised to learn that a reviewer in the Washington Post wrote, "Jacobson was the man for The Merchant of Venice. He took on the assignment and has delivered with authority and style." Of course he has. He'll be joined this evening by award-winning author Boris Fishman. When Mr. Fishman's National Jewish Book Award nominated first novel, A Replacement Life, was published in 2014, a critic writing for the New York Times exclaimed, "Is there room in American fiction for another brilliant young emigre writer? There had better be, because here he is. And here he is to offer his humorously and invitingly titled new road novel, Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo. I dare you to say it without smiling." Please welcome our first presenter, Boris Fishman.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm so pleased to be here with Howard Jacobson. Usually the people I read with don't have as much wisdom to impart about what awaits and doesn't. and I've been eagerly downloading it backstage, and I will continue to when we speak here in a little bit. I don't know how many of you know anything about my first novel. It was called The Replacement Life. And it was about a young man, a failed writer, who starts forging Holocaust restitution claims for old Russian Jews in South Brooklyn. And obviously, because the first question always let me preempt it for you, how much of this is autobiographical, allow me to answer in advance that I did not forge anyone's claims. But that aside, of course, that like many first novels, that draws so heavily from personal experience. With my second book, I wanted to go as far as I could from the things that I knew without tipping into fantasy. That's not a particular interest of mine. So how far could realism take me? I decided to write a novel about parenthood and adoption and how women see the world. Right? I can't get any... I should let you know I'm not a parent. Not an adopted child, have only seen one rodeo in my life, and so forth. I'm going to read a brief segment that will introduce you to this book and bring you into some of the questions that I hope to explore. How much do you need to know? Basically, the one-line elevator pitch for this novel, because that's what you have to come up with, is an immigrant couple in New Jersey adopts a boy from Montana who turns out to be wild, feral. And about midway through the book, because you don't always know everything, in fact, you shouldn't know everything at the outset, about midway through the book, I realized that I was inverting the way this works usually. Usually you have American parents adopting an Eastern European child who is terrorized or traumatized in some way. part of the reason that I was drawn to this particular dynamic is because Max, the boy from Montana, he is a consummate native, even more than perhaps than someone from the East Coast. To this day, even with the myths of the West having been discredited as they have been, we still associate that part of the country with a certain authenticity that we liberal, nervous East Coasters don't quite assign to ourselves. But in this family of immigrants, he's the foreigner. Meanwhile, they're foreigners in America, because even after 25 years in this country, they're this type of immigrant who has never gone west of New Jersey, knows absolutely nothing about the psychological and political currents of this land, and yet somehow manages to feel like a full-fledged citizen. It's certainly not the way things worked 100 years ago when the last great wave of immigrants from Eastern Europe came to America. Those people couldn't wait to assimilate. These days, you could live in Brighton Beach in South Brooklyn, never learn English, only listen to Russian radio, read Russian newspapers, and feel like a full-fledged American. And so these people, though they are a generation younger, are of that ilk. However, not both of them. The husband, the adoptive father, Alex, is like that. But his wife, Maya, is more open-ended to new experience. It's just something that's been stymied by having been adopted by his family. Because he immigrated with his whole family, she came as an exchange student, fell in love with Alex, and stayed. The only other thing that you should know is that there's a great stigma attached to adoption in a Russian family. like any people eager to assert their worth and value, Russians don't do well with anything that isn't a brand name, with cast-off things. And adoption falls under the same logic. Alex even says at one point in the novel, adopted children are second class. By definition, it's because somebody else didn't want them. We all know how false that logic is, but my interest in this novel wasn't to vilify or harangue. It was simply to represent characters in the full truth of their psychology. So these are the people that you're about to meet, and you're about to meet them in the adoption agency as they look for their son. In the waiting area, portraits of successfully placed children and their new parents, usually on the steps of the courthouse where the transfer had been blessed by the law, faced off against childless couples that aspired to migrate to the opposite wall. Maya, Alex, and their sad compatriots studied the wall of success. The pregnant women who came in, Maya observing them like the other party in a car accident, studied the Mayas and Alexes. Maya was shocked the first time she saw a pregnant woman walk in, then chastised herself for her thickness. Of course, the agency would serve both sides. The effortlessly full-bellied women read the prospective parent profiles like personal ads, savoring a power that, by their looks, they had rarely, if ever, enjoyed. She hated them. She hated them because they held the power, and she hated them because they were pregnant. I should point out that Maya and Alex are unable to conceive, is why they're looking to adopt. Feeling a modest hysteria, Maya would snatch a palmful of cookies from the center console that held the uneasy peace between the parents already and the parents they wish, and gnash the cookies mindlessly, hating herself as she did it. Generally, though, she directed the anger that pooled in her throat at the agency staff, which treated women who wanted to give up their children like wounded angels, and people who wanted to turn their lives upside down to make room for a foreign child like criminals until proven otherwise. It's social engineering, only legal, Mishkin, the adoption supervisor, had noted. You Russians should know something about that. If Mishkin had not accosted the Rubens one afternoon, trying on them the smattering of mangled Russian in his possession, he had overheard them whispering, quite possibly they would have remained childless. The slab-faced matron to whom they had initially been assigned had been terrorizing them into confessing their unpreparedness, their unwillingness, their doubt. Slabface could have been 40 or 70. Did the Rubens own guns? Fire extinguishers? Were the outlets sealed? Her red pen hovered over a clipboard. Maya and Alex exchanged looks. Was she joking? Slabface barreled on. Where had they lived? Every state would need a background check. They hadn't crossed the river to live in New York, had they? Because New York was the worst. The Rubens, she went on, would have to produce a self-advertisement like the ones in the waiting area. Think of it like a newspaper personal, she advised. You want to go steady with the birth parents. What can you offer? Spotting the Rubens' unease, she raised her chin. Oh yes, you have to. How did you become involved with adoptions? Alex mustered. He coughed lightly. I've got two little ones. Slabface whipped out a photograph of two bantam-sized brown children, flanking her abundance as all three roared behind the seat rail of a roller coaster. It's possible to adopt at all ages? Alex said, and Maya stared at him with mortification. He means the children's ages, she rushed to add. Perhaps Slabface would have been willing to forego a personal verification of the Rubens' claims regarding firearms and ammunition, but comments like these, on steady supply from Alex, guaranteed otherwise. Slabface arrived on a rainy afternoon wearing the same house dress in which they had found her at the office and proceeded to test the edges of their countertops, flick their stove burners, measure the height of their steps. The Rubens remained glumly seated at the kitchen table. Maya experienced a great gratitude to her husband for saying nothing about what she had dragged the pair of them into. Also for not mentioning the duration and cost of the adoption, a year and around $20,000, depending on what the birth parents want. What do you mean what the birth parents want? Alex asked, thinking of Soviet bribes. They'll tell you that at orientation, Slabface said, reluctantly marking home inspection pass rather than fail on the clipboard. Orientation, Alex said. The orientation, a statewide colloquy in an oceanside town, was attended by 9 couples and 2 solos, 1 female and 1 male, setting off in Alex's mind uneasy speculation about whether the solitary man's wife was merely ill, or here was a man taking on parenthood all by himself. Of the other 8 couples, 3 were gay and 2 religious, the latter signified by pins that said, Building God's Army. The Rubens' eyes clung to the remaining heterosexual parents like floaters in a cold ocean. A lot of Russian people feel about homosexuality roughly the way they feel about adoption. Perhaps I don't need to point out. Alex had never touched a gay man before, but now he was holding one's hand as the 20 participants formed a grieving circle to commemorate their failed fertility. Why were the gays grieving? They hadn't been failed by fertility. They had been failed by their dicks. He and Maya had been failed by fertility. And as the assembled strode and chanted, Alex absented himself by trying to guess which half of the other 2 normal couples, for that is the way Alex thought of them, was the sterile one. Was it the pale face and glasses or his zebra-faced wife? Was it the ham-shouldered redhead with the page boy or her equally cavernous beau, wheezing like an asthmatic as they pounded the floor? Cupid loves every kind. After lunch, which Alex and Maya had passed eyeing with envy the camaraderie starting between the other castaways, the group received a PowerPoint presentation on the various scams they could expect to encounter as parents in waiting. Financial scams, one screen said. What other kind is there? Alex wondered. Emotional scams, the next screen said. Women will put up profiles claiming to look for adoption, the lecturer said. They'll interview you, they'll spend hours with you on the phone, and in the end, there's no child. They're just lonely. Meanwhile, you've been riding the roller coaster. The lecturer moved on, but Maya felt that a crucial piece of information was being left out, though she was too shy to raise her hand. How could a person protect himself from this kind of scam? Should she and her husband demand photos of a sloped belly as a precondition of talks? A signed certificate from the gynecologist? A meeting? Then she disobediently realized that she would not mind talking to this woman, the emotional scammer. She would prefer to know, of course, that there was no child, but this lonely, desperate charlatan struck her as someone with whom she could have a long talk indeed. That night, the Rubens were given homework, the profile that would hang on the agency wall. Like the other applicants, they got a packet of samples and an instant camera, and were instructed to capture, between then and the next morning, three images that the rest of the group, play-acting birth mothers and fathers, would cull for the one that made them say, "I want to give my child to these people." Alex and Maya had not filled out an application since writing colleges 15 years before, and that was colleges. They were applying for a human being this time. How could one begin to answer the question of why one deserved to become the parent of a child carried and birthed by another? It was like being asked who one was and what one planned to do about it. Of course they were loving and patient and generous. Why would they ask to adopt otherwise? But so was everyone else filling out these forms. One had to be oneself. But what if oneself was generic? In the seaside motel room, rented with their orientation fees by the agency, Maya wondered what the other participants were writing. Alex didn't think they were writing. They were out on the town with each other, bonding. He was at the small table by the window, Maya curled up on the bed, which smelled of industrial laundry detergent. Daylight began to merge with dark outside. Should they emphasize their hard work as immigrants? Downplay their religion? Try to be funny? Should they say they read books, or would that be looked upon with disfavor by mothers struggling with reduced circumstances? But they would want to donate their children to book-reading parents, wouldn't they? However, the Rubens didn't actually read books. With no forewarning, the assignment had brought on an existential self-examination that they hadn't requested. Thank you. I don't want to be up here for much longer because I'd rather listen to Howard. And I'd rather move on to the conversation later where all of you will be encouraged to join us. But I just want to tell you one thing. It wasn't a random choice to try to explore the experience of parenthood and adoption and out of a female consciousness. Maya, the heroine of the story, represents a certain type of Russian woman, and perhaps sometimes an American woman as well, that may be familiar to you. Someone whose culture and context expects her to give away certain parts of herself in order to become somebody's mother and somebody's daughter-in-law and somebody's wife. It's certainly what was expected of my mother, who was a kind of inspiration to me for this book. And what I wanted to explore in this novel was a certain kind of fantasy of a woman reared in that kind of culture deciding at a certain point that she is no longer able to live that way, and deciding on a kind of reckoning with herself about what she has given away and whether it's any longer possible to get back anything that was there before it was. And when one undertakes that kind of project, personal identity project, where does the shrapnel fly? Because now there are children and there are people who depend on you being whom you've acted like you're comfortable being for the past 25 years. The novel asks the question of how do we reconcile who we are with whom the world wants us to be. And above all, that's what motivated me to write it. That kind of female experience that I've seen around me so often in the community that I come from. I was in Washington, D.C. last night. I told a quick story about a lifelong passion that my mother has had, which is to work with flowers. It's something that she's never allowed herself to do. She undertook a more responsible job, so to speak. But now that she's nearing retirement, she has earned her pleasures, at least in my view. And because I'm friendly with the owner of a flower store in New York, I said, "Nick, would you be willing to have my mom come one Saturday and sweep your floors?" Because literally that's what she said. I would sweep the floors in the flower shop. And Nick, who is a rare kind of business owner in New York, said, "Sweep the floors, don't be crazy. Put her on the line, we'll teach her how to make bouquets." My mother probably didn't sleep for 3 nights before that Saturday. She was so nervous. But to her everlasting credit, she got it together and she went. And she had the time of her life. And Nick said to her when she was leaving, "This spot is yours every weekend. And if you want to quit your job, every day too." And she never went back. And I told this story last night, and a fellow Russian friend came up to me afterward and said, she said, I think your mother is amazing, because in my mom's case, I don't even know what that hobby would be. And so it's a kind of fantasy of the women that raised us, these heroic, resilient Russian women whom we admire so much, a fantasy of their coming to America and deciding to upend everything to get their groove back. And of course, it doesn't work so straightforwardly, but that was my inspiration in working on the book. I'll cut it off there and invite Howard Jacobson to the stage.
Hello, lovely to see you here, lovely to be back here, and lovely to see some beloved friends here. Terrific. Listening to Boris, I wish I had a moving story about my mother to tell like that. The only moving story about my mother I can tell at this moment when I have a new book out is that whenever I send my mother my new book, she said it. She holds it up and she looks at it. She says, she opens it up and she says, your first novel was terrific. We were just discussing that backstage. You're never forgiven your first novel. Particularly if your first novel is good, you're never forgiven your first novel. You have to keep producing it. I was asked to, when I was finishing my previous novel, Jay, and I was at that stage of the novel where I normally feel I know what I'm going to be writing next because I should be writing it while I'm writing this novel, which I'm impatient with, and it's foolish of me to be writing this novel, so I'll now write the novel I should be writing. That didn't happen with my previous novel, which might mean it was a perfect novel or I was perfectly satisfied with it. So when my agent rang and said, Hogarth Press have come up with this idea to write a modern novel based on a contemporary novel, based in any way you like on a Shakespeare play, it seemed good to me because I had nothing else that I wanted to do. And somewhere at the back of my mind, I'd always hankered to write. Never had a desire particularly to do a modernization of anything else. But there was one thing I'd thought about doing for many years, and that was a novel called Malvolio's Revenge. You remember at the end of that play, Malvolio storms off saying, I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you. It's a wonderful moment that upturns the whole of that comedy and probably the whole of Shakespearean comedy. And I always fancied writing that revenge. But otherwise, I had no interest in doing something like this. But okay, it was a challenge. They said, you can do whatever, you can base it on whatever play you like. I said, Hamlet. They went, mm. I said, Macbeth then. So we went through this, with my agent being as the go-between, we went through all the early comedies, we went through the tragedies, we went through the problem plays, we went through the late plays, we went through, finally we were at King John and Two Noble Kinsmen. And I still hadn't named the play that they'd wanted me to do, because although I could do any play, there was only play they really wanted me to do, and that was The Merchant of Venice. And they were astonished that I'd not thought of doing that. But I'd not thought of doing that because I'd never had any interest in the play, because I'd done it at school when I was 14, and the teacher at the school had said, Jacobson, you can be Shylock. And from that moment, I'd felt uncomfortable about the play. But okay, I reread it. And thought, this is terrific, and there's all sorts of things I can do with this. Not least, I can do a version of the novel I'd always wanted to do, which was Malvolio's Revenge, because Shylock never walks out and says, I will be revenged on the whole pack of you, but one wishes he did. One wishes he said that, and one wishes he were revenged on the whole pack of them. I haven't written a novel in which he gets his revenge. That would be false to Shylock and false to Shakespeare and false to the premise of this. But I give him a little something at the end. One of the things I do is give him an Act 5. You know that the play seems to fall to pieces at the end of Act 4 because Shylock leaves, and when Shylock's gone, what have you got? So I, in this novel, give him an Act 5. But I'm not going to read you that. I'm going to read you the beginning, a bit of the beginning. which raises all the questions about, you know, why I've done it the way I've done it. It begins in a cemetery. Anybody who reads me will know that I now begin all my novels in a cemetery, or end all my novels in a cemetery, or have the entirety of the action in a cemetery. Where else, after all, at my age, do you want to set a novel? It is one of those better to be dead than alive days you get in the north of England in February. The space between the land and sky, a mere letterbox of squeezed light. The sky itself unfathomably banal. A stage unsuited to tragedy, even here where the dead lie quietly. There are two men in the cemetery, occupied in duties of the heart. They don't look up. In these parts, you must wage war against the weather if you don't want farce to claim you. Signs of just such a struggle are etched on the faces. Let me say that again. Signs of just such a struggle are etched on the face of the first of the mourners, a man of middle-aged and uncertain bearing, who sometimes walks with his head held arrogantly high, and at others stoops as though hoping not to be seen. His mouth, too, is twitchy and misleading. His lips, one moment twisted into a sneer, the next fallen softly open, as vulnerable to bruising as summer fruit. He is Simon Strulevich, a rich, furious, easily hurt philanthropist with on-again, off-again enthusiasms, a distinguished collection of 20th century Anglo-Jewish art and old Bibles, a passion for Shakespeare, whose genius and swashbuckling Sephardi looks he once thought could only be explained by the playwright's ancestors having changed their name from Shapiro. But now he isn't sure. Honorary doctorates from universities in London, Manchester, and Tel Aviv. The one from Tel Aviv is something else he isn't sure about. And a daughter going off the rails. He is here to inspect the stone that has recently been erected at the head of his mother's grave, now that the 12 months of mourning for her has elapsed. He hasn't mourned her conscientiously during that period, too busy buying and lending art, too busy with his foundations and endowments, or benefacting, as his mother called it, with a mixture of pride and concern. She didn't want her boy killing himself, giving money away. Too busy settling scores in his head, too busy with his daughter. But he intends to make amends. There is always time to be a better son or a better father. Could it be that it's his daughter he's really getting ready to mourn? These things run in families. His father had briefly mourned him. "You are dead to me." And why? Because of his bride's religion. Yet his father wasn't himself in the slightest bit religious. "Better you were dead at my feet." Would that really have been better? We can't get enough of dying, he thinks, shuffling between the unheralded headstones. We, an idea of belonging to which he sometimes subscribes and sometimes doesn't. We arrive, lucky to be alive, carrying our belongings on a stick, and immediately look for somewhere to bury the children who betray us. Perhaps because of all the anger that precedes all the burying, the place lacks the consolation of beauty. It all finishes here. There is a lingering of snow on the ground, turning a dirty black where it nestles into the granite of the graves. It will be there until early summer, if summer ever comes. The second person here, long before Strulevich arrived, tenderly addressing the occupant of a grave whose headstone is worn to nothing, is Shylock, also an infuriated and tempestuous Jew, though his fury tends more to the sardonic than the mercurial, and the tempest subsides when he is able to enjoy the company of his wife Leah, buried deep beneath the snow. He is less divided in himself than Strulevich, but perhaps for that very reason, more divisive. No two people feel the same about him. Even those who unreservedly despise him with different degrees of unreservation. He has money worries that Strulevich doesn't, collects neither art nor Bibles, and finds it difficult to be charitable where people are not charitable to him, which some would say takes something from the soul of charity. About his daughter, the least said the better. He's not an occasional mourner like Strulevich. He cannot leave and think of something else. Because he is not a forgetful or a forgiving man, there never was or will be something else. Strulevich, pausing in his reflections, feels Shylock's presence before he sees him. A blow to the back of the neck, as though someone in the cemetery has been irreverent enough to throw a snowball. The words, "My dearest Leia," dropped like blessings into the icy grave, reach Strulevich's ears. There will be many Leias here. Strulevich's own mother was a Leia. But this Leia attracts an imperishable piteousness to her name that is unmistakable to Strulevich, student of husbandly sorrow and fatherly wroth. Leia, who bought Shylock a courtship ring. Leia, mother to Jessica, who stole that ring to buy a monkey. Jessica, the pattern of perfidy. Not for a wilderness of monkeys would Shylock have parted with that ring. Strulevich neither. So "we" does mean something to Strulevich after all. The faith Jessica violates is his faith. Such, anyway, are the only clues to recognition Strulevich needs. He is hard-headed about it. Of course Shylock is here among the dead. When hasn't he been? I'll leave it at that. I'm half inclined to read a bit from the funnier, more sardonic, more ironic sections, but maybe we'll leave that to later on and sort of finish at that note, and you were brief, I'll be brief, and we'll talk.
I just want to give Mr. Fishman an example of what my mother did, who was a first-generation born American. And in 1913, her parents came, of course, from Russia at that time. She was older. She took a painting course at the Baltimore Museum of Art, didn't like what she did, cleaned the canvas off, and went home never to return. So I thought that might sound a little familiar that way to you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, maybe my mom was just like, flowers suck. I don't want to do this. But at least she tested the fantasy. There's nothing worse than an untested fantasy. That's the surest way to keep it alive.
For Mr. Fishman, I'm curious about what kind of research you did for your novel. I was struck with the verisimilitude and the humor of the section that you read. I wonder if you attended these sessions. Also wonder what kind of research, and I don't mean scholarly, but in this case personal, you did in that made you able to enter into the mind of a woman who's your main character. So two questions, really.
Great questions. So one of the things I learned with my first novel, and I feel like you would agree with this, is there is such a thing as doing too much research. There's a huge whole section in that novel that I had researched to death, and I'd found so many wonderful tidbits that I just could not manage to keep them out, and they ended up weighing the novel down like ballast because I was so focused on the great stuff I'd found in the books, I forgot to make drama out of it. And so this time, I knew that I was entering into even less familiar territory. There was even more to learn, but it was equally important to limit myself so the imagination could take over at a certain point. So what I did was I spoke to adoptive parents. I asked them for sketches of what they had gone through. Sometimes I purposefully did not take notes, so I had nothing to go back to and glean the jewels from. If it stuck with me, then it was good enough to keep in. And usually I find that I'm so helped by having a little morsel to start chewing on, but then I want nothing else in my mouth to continue the metaphor. I just want to then run with it on my own. And so it was a balance. But I did speak to adoptive parents. As for a female consciousness, I myself was a bit surprised by how naturally that came to me. I think it does have to do with growing up at the knee of these Amazonian Russian women. But what's interesting about them psychologically is that there's this cult of selflessness that obtains for a woman from that part of the world, and perhaps from this part of the world too. But they're not machines. They have feelings and needs. They're just not authorized to convey those needs directly. They're not allowed to own them. But they still continue transmitting them, just between the lines. So you have to just work a little bit harder to understand. From the age of zero, I was learning to read between the lines of what the women in my life were communicating to me. I think it's actually no small part of the reason why I'm a writer. because that overlaps with what a writer has to do. It's to receive the meaning behind what the person is saying. You sometimes see it come up in dialogue. So I was sniffing out these women for a long time. And I think, to my own surprise, it was Alex who wouldn't come alive, whereas Maya just sprung to life fully formed. And it was such a joyride to just roll with her. I don't think I made the connection for you, but it's Maya who ends up having an experience in the novel, the kind of fantasy fulfillment that I referred to with regard to my mom. She's the one, at a slightly younger age, who decides to undergo a kind of reckoning with the compromises that she's made.
I don't think you have to be a woman to know about a woman. It's possible that men, let me put this another way, it's possible that Jewish men know more about women than a woman will ever know, because a Jewish man absorbs something from his mother, and exactly as you've described, and knows more about his mother than the mother knows about him, about himself. So if you want to know anything about a woman, if there's a woman here that wants to know about herself, ask a Jewish man, and there are two here that you could talk to.
It's such a good point. I'm gonna take that.
Mr. Jacobson, can you... Sorry, I have a cough.
I can't see where you are.
I'm here.
Ah, hello.
Hello. Can you describe the path by which such a generous writer such as yourself writes so brilliantly and accurately about schadenfreude and sibling rivalry?
Oh, that's dead easy. I have reached the age of four. I am brought up by a mother who's... whole being I know, and her sister, whose entire being I know, and their mother, my grandmother. And these three women dance attendance on me and are delighted by everything. Every word that comes out of my mouth is a work of genius. My looks are such as they have never seen before. I can dance. They marvel at my height. They all believed I was going to be a dancer because I had the long, svelte build of a dancer. My father is in the army. There is just me. I have the three of them entirely to myself. And then one day I am told to go and live with my grandma for a couple of weeks because I've got chicken pox or something or other, or the measles, and it's not good for me to be near my mother, who's been acting strangely for a little while. And then I'm with my grandmother for 10 days, and then she says, come, I'm going to show you something. And she takes me down the street, because we only lived a few doors from each other, and I stand, as I like to think, in the gutter, and look up at the window of my house, and there is my mother holding a new child. But not just showing it to me, not just going, look, she's holding it like that. As I see it almost by the ears, like a cup. She's just won this cup. And this is a prize. This is a... whatever I was never held up like. This is the prize. And now everything that comes out of this child's mouth is of such a wisdom that they've never heard. And he's not pretty. He's a beautiful. But isn't he a beautiful boy? Does that give it to you?
My mother loved me so much, she never allowed herself to have another child.
Then you don't know about schadenfreude and envy. Write to me.
Howard, which of you knows your mother better, you or your sibling?
Oh, I know my mother much better than he does. Far, far better than he does, yes. I was in there earlier. See, I
got there. Got the stretch on him. Another question. Yes, sir.
Yeah, or out of there sooner. Is there a commonality of experience, you writing in America, you writing in England, of course, between the immigré Jewish experience, between the Jewish experience writing, winning a Booker Prize, is there a commonality of experience that brings the two of you together or separates you from mainstream American or mainstream English writers?
Well, I'll kick it off. I haven't read Boris's new novel. I've read his first novel, and I thought, you know, with every Jewish writer, there is much in common. I feel whenever I read that there isn't an American Jewish writer that I don't feel I have a great deal in common with, though I never got to being a writer through reading American Jewish novelists or any Jewish novelist. I got to being a novelist through reading Dickens and George Eliot and Jane Austen and Shakespeare. So I come absolutely from the English tradition, but then couldn't get anywhere as an English writer. I don't mean couldn't get anybody to read what I'd written. I mean I couldn't write anything until I wrote as a Jew. It's a strange thing. What I mean by writing as a Jew, I don't know. But I suppose it was finding a voice which I felt was alien to my culture. And as soon as I found an alien voice to write in, I realised that was my voice, though I hadn't known before that was my voice, and I thought, I'm a stranger in this culture which I love and which I teach. I'm actually a little bit of a stranger. And to that degree, that's partly both our subject, isn't it? And will remain, whatever we do, will remain both our subject. What I often say about American, you're a different kind of an American writer because you weren't born here. So you were strange. But for me, every Jew is not a stranger in America. For me, I've kind of looked for years at America as a place. If only I'd been born in America, people would know what I'm talking about. Whereas I have often felt, writing my books for the English, that they're tolerant of them, patient of them, appreciative of them, and they're even mad enough to give me prizes for them. But I'm not convinced they've ever quite got what it is that I'm doing. When I did win the Booker Prize for A Finkler Question, and I attended some Jewish groups afterwards, and the Jewish people in England were so delighted that I'd won this prize because I'd like won it for them. I was suddenly part of the Jewish family. And I was vast audiences, and I was greeted like a hero, like Moshe Dayan coming back from I was Moshe Dayan. And there'd always be a moment, a question would come towards the end, and it was a room full of Jews. And this question, the man would look around, usually a man who had the, why do I say, it was, he'd look around and say, as if there might be somebody here who shouldn't be listening, and he said, and they'd always the same question, do they get this book? Do they know what they've given a prize to? And all I could say, well, is I have to assume so. But they felt, the Jews in England do feel very much at home in England and safe in England, but there's a little part of them, and maybe it's the most creative part of them, that feels they're working somewhere else. And where that somewhere, and if they could find that somewhere else, they would be more at home. And I've always assumed it's America. But what I don't know is whether you feel at home in America in the way I would love to feel at home.
Yeah, Jews are the new white people. I mean, it's... our times of outsiderness are over. I will never forget one of the first assignments I had as a journalist was to write a story for the New York Times, to go to London, write a story for the New York Times magazine, a profile of an Orthodox Jewish man, Simon Cohen, who was a collector of anti-Semitic art. And this was rich novelistic terrain, which I then was not a good enough journalist to capture. But, I mean, at the end of the day, there was no big smoking gun there. He was just a collector, and collectors are acquisitive, whatever it is that they're acquiring, be it anti-Semitic art that he was claiming to get off the streets or something else. But I was absolutely stunned to discover that the place of Jews in England was so very different than, maybe place is a bad word, but sort of Jewish life in England was nothing like Jewish life in America. I'm certain that no small part of the reason that my first novel was received so well is because it fell so squarely into something so classifiable and welcome. I mean, at this point in time, American literature is getting a lot of its energy from immigrant literature. And novels like Portnoy's Complaint or King of the Jews by Leslie Epstein are shocking to no one, neither Jews nor non-Jews. And I was so gratified to have that reception. But you know what the question that follows is, you're immediately tagged an American Jewish writer or a Jewish American writer. And my response to that was the response that Bernard Malamud had, where he said exactly what you said. I write for all men. I just sort of happen to know about Jews. But my stories are for the world. It's just Jews are experiencing these predicaments. And I realized that while you were speaking, I realized that this novel is a kind of provocation. Will you still love me if I'm not really writing about Jews? Am I good only because I can write a Jewish novel, or am I good because I can write a novel? Because this novel is about foreignness and belonging. These people are Jews, and the actions they take and fail to take, and the decisions they make are deeply informed by the fact that they're Jewish immigrants from the former Soviet Union. But my thumb isn't so heavy on that scale the way it was topically with the first novel. And I'm so curious to see how this novel will be responded to in that context.
How brave of you to do that so quickly in your second novel. It took me about my 20th before I'd... But I can tell you that...
I'm eager for disappointment.
It's not fair. It might be different with you, but my experience is, you know, to the question, will you still love me when I'm not writing Jewish? No, we won't. I hope it's entirely different for you. But maybe I couldn't write on Jewish. Because for me, although, I mean, I like that Malamud thing, and one says it, of course, I am writing for all people, and it doesn't seem to me, I just happen to be Jewish, doesn't quite do it. There is something else that I feel that there is to exploit as a writer in being Jewish. A huge advantage that which we could spend, you know, a week talking about. A huge advantage which to ignore would seem to me to be a kind of crime. An advantage of wit, an advantage of rage. One of the things I most enjoyed about writing my Shylock novel is how much of this I was able to give Shylock as kind of perennials, really, because Shylock isn't a Jew of now. When is he a Jew of is the real question. When Shakespeare invented Shylock, there were no Jews there. Shakespeare wrote Shylock out of a total ignorance of Jews, and yet somehow the genius was to make him Jewish. Sorry, you were going to say something.
I was going to say that. That is exactly right. When reading your work, one senses that pleasure in the richness of the possibilities. Whereas for me, I feel like it's more like unease. And I think the reason for that is because we're forgetting the Soviet element. It's not just a British and American story. It's also a Soviet story. And this is a place where Jews were made to feel like second-class citizens. And even though I was only 9 when I left, that legacy came with me because my parents and my grandparents had experienced it from birth. And these are people who look normal and healthy on the outside, but are victims of deep trauma on the inside. And because they continued to live in these enclaves of Russian life in America that allow them to just... I called it the swamp broth of Soviet Brooklyn in my first novel. It just perpetuates and perpetuates. And, you know, maybe this is actually quintessentially American, but they're exposed only to like-minded voices, you know? And that gift just keeps on giving through the generations. It's what I mean by that is lowering your voice when you say the word Jewish. And no matter how hard I have worked to dialyze that out of my system, because of course that is not my context during most of the day or in my enclave. God, how uneager it is to let go of me. And so there's an ambivalence with being labeled an American Jewish writer for me that may not be the same for Howard.
Yeah, well, that's, I can't claim that growing up Jewish in England is like growing up Jewish in Russia. I was brought up to lower my voice when saying the word Jewish, just that. And when I wrote my first novel and talked about being Jewish, so what's that in the early 80s, things have changed in those 30 years. But there were a lot of my friends and members of my family thought, don't draw attention to you. If I don't mention I'm Jewish, nobody would notice.
The critique of Philip Roth not being, well, I guess he was a contender, but taken off of the short list, is that the feeling was that he was too localized. So that reduces what Philip Roth's achievement is in terms of that bigger statement that you're talking about. that writers achieve, no matter what voice they use, if they're successful.
Do you agree with that?
So what you're saying is you're referring to the Nobel Prize?
Yes.
And the fact that he is not, he's off the short list because what he writes is ultimately too local to make...
That was the critique.
By?
He's won every... Philip Roth won every award that was that you could get in the United States and the Americas and probably internationally. And yet the big prize is the one he didn't receive.
But who is that assessment by?
Members of the committee that went public when they were pressed on it. I mean, it's, you know, because localized could be, I wouldn't say a buzzword. I couldn't say that it's a, it's not like the word cosmopolitan was decades ago.
I see what you mean. Why don't we let these gentlemen answer the question, Celeste?
You know, I don't know how they give prizes in the first place. I don't know how it's possible to achieve some kind of uniformity of opinion on a writer, just because... This may sound like I'm avoiding your question. I'm not. I'll get to it in a second. But every reading experience, it's like falling in love. It's so subjective and personal. I'm always puzzled when, like, you know, 25 people have agreed that this person has the same exact impact on all of them, and by the way, also on humanity, you know? and it's always, of course, very frustrating for me when I pick up a book by this sanctified, anointed person and can't get anywhere with it. I don't know. I'm not Philip Roth's number one fan, but I feel like he's reached perfectly universal parameters with his work. If someone reads something that's technically local and there's the art in it to have universal consequences, it's often the failure of the reader to perceive them that's at play. But I don't know. I don't know how to answer the question. Howard?
I mean, I think if there's any literary prize going, Philip Roth should win it. I mean, I am a Philip Roth admirer. I'm a huge admirer. I don't think there's been a better writer in the last 50 years than Philip Roth. Philip Roth, when a Philip Roth sentence is going,
oh yeah,
it is a wondrous thing. Back in London, the Jewish community have their own ideas about why Philip Roth has not won the Nobel Prize, and that's the usual one when any Jew doesn't get anything. It's, you know, and who knows if one thinks of a bunch of Swedish, I don't know who judges the Nobel Prize, but when you think of them, they are kind of fair-haired, eyebrowless, you know, Swedish Lutherans. They're not going to enjoy Philip Roth, are they?
Dry fish is the Russian term for those people.
Yes, and his politics are no good. But I don't know but the other thing that's worth saying is, does it even matter in the end? I mean, I don't believe. Maybe he's sitting there sweating on it and thinking, why haven't I won this? But I've always minimised prizes. Having won a prize, I see the importance of it. But the importance of it really is that it gets you read where you were not read before. And when people don't know you, you win a prize, they know you. Everybody knows Philip Roth. He doesn't need to earn any more money, and he doesn't need to have any more readers, and he doesn't need to be translated into any more countries. I think it's a scandal, but I don't think it matters.
I agree completely. Where I diverge is that I do believe he's thinking about it.
You move from a mortified 14-year-old who didn't want to play Shylock to a gentleman who's now written, however many decades later, a book named My Name is Shylock. How do you feel about him now?
Now? Well, now, the Shylock of my novel is a heroic figure. I do not feel that I've made him a heroic figure in despite of Shakespeare. I think he is a... Heroic might not be the right way of putting it, but a person of immense stature, moral stature, despite many things we might not, you know, we might question in him. I've not invented that. And I'm not the first to think that's what the play is. I have an my novel is a ferocious argument. It's full of rage, actually. Shylock's rage, partly, but also my rage. But it's not a rage with the play. I think the play is... I don't think it's Shakespeare's greatest play, but I think on the question of Shylock, it's quite marvellous. It's marvellous about Shylock. My rage is the way the play has been misread. It's been misread, grossly misread, for centuries, partly by people who have a vested interest in seeing it as an anti-Semitic play. It's not for nothing that it was the play that the play of Shakespeare's that the Nazis most wanted to see. They just, you know, it was on every 5 minutes in every town in Germany. They loved it. That was the Jew they wanted to see. The only problem they had was Jessica eloping with an Aryan. So they had to find a way of making Jessica not Jewish. So they discovered, they came up with the idea, they would put it in the play, they came up with the idea that, in fact, Shylock had been cuckolded by Leia, the wife, and that she'd been sleeping with somebody else. So it was that you've got to have a very devious mind to realise that that's a problem. Jessica, she's run off with an Aryan. What's an Aryan doing with a Jewish girl, even one who abjures the faith? But my... people have read the play anti-Semitically because they choose to see it like that. And also, I think many Jews have read the play anti-Semitically because it touches some anxiety they have about their own Jewishness. In Shylock, I think some Jews have seen a figure that they're frightened of, a figure of something vicious and maybe parochial and maybe ancient that they fear might be lingering in themselves. And they most shamefully idealize the Gentiles in the play. The biggest misreading of the play, I think, is to think that Portia is wonderful. Portia isn't wonderful. Portia is vile. She's an absolutely vile woman. She makes one or two beautiful speeches that Shakespeare sticks on her like a badge. But when Portia speaks for mercy, that's not Portia. That is Shakespeare, and I can kind of prove that to you, because there's nothing in Portia to suggest that she has those sorts of feelings. Whenever she's expressed herself before, it's been in a bigoted, flippant, malapert and gross way, really, and suddenly she makes this beautiful speech. We have, for centuries, readers have conspired to over-admire the world of Portia and Antonio and to take them at their own valuation. These are people who think that they have refined feelings. I have great fun in this novel cruelly parodying them. Shakespeare doesn't parody them. He just writes about them with utter disdain. I think this is one of the bleakest plays Shakespeare ever wrote, not because it's problematic about Shylock, who actually is created with immense verve and charm, but because I think Shakespeare is just so offhandedly disgusted with the other ones. So it wasn't difficult for me to find my nature found in Shakespeare what I wanted to find in Shakespeare. It's true, but I'm rapt to have found it. It's there. And so what I enjoyed was giving Shylock a lot to say for himself, because he's got a lot to talk about.
Well, we are out of time. I don't know if you had intended to read a brief little bit or not.
Well, if we're really out of time, there probably isn't time to do it.
Okay. Yeah, we've got about 3 minutes.
Have you got a bit of 3 minutes you want to read?
No, I think you should read.
Yeah, what if you've got something that's...
I don't think it lasts... Well, I'll just give you a quick flavour. I've set the world of Portia's Belmont. You remember she has this rarefied world. I've set it in south of Manchester in Cheshire, in North Cheshire, where the footballers live, heiresses live, pop singers live, people with a lot of money live. And this is just the bit how it begins. There lived once in a big old house, equidistant from Mottram St. Andrew, Alderley Edge and Wimslow, at the very heart of what is still known to estate agents as the Golden Triangle, a dope-smoking media don who disapproved of dope and media, heir to a pharmaceutical fortune who favoured the redistribution of all wealth but his own, a utopist who mistrusted the principle of social amelioration, a lover of a Gregorian chant who fantasized about being a rock legend, a whimsical conservationist who bought his son's fast cars with which they tore up the very country roads he wanted conserving. If he sounds like many people, it's because many people were wrapped up in him, but he was just one man, a single fretting bundle of idealistic envy with an aversion to Jews. Sometimes, he told his students at the business school of which he was the dean, even the fortunate and gifted can feel their lives a mortgage to a perplexing sadness. "You don't say," said his students behind his back. For Peter Shawcroft, MBE, one day had become the same as every other, a live morning radio interview on any subject, an afternoon lecture to his students on mercantilism and alienation. On alternate weeks, he changed the title to Money and Estrangement, and then the drive home into the early evening to the heart of the Golden Triangle, where a neat scotch and scarlet smoking jacket awaited him, and where he could fulminate in comfort against the faux manses and manor houses of which the Struloviches and their brethren had taken possession.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.